Alright, so this this presentation is on a condition called water on the brain, or in other words, otherwise known as hydrocephalus. Emma chose this because Junior, who's a character in our book, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, he actually has this condition, and it's like mentioned in the first chapter, I believe, on the first page. So, we'll just be going into that. But what is it? It comes from a Greek word, hydro, which everyone knows is water, and then cephalus, which means head. So, like, it's obviously a condition where, like, there's something going on with, like, the fluid in your head, and it's kind of in the name, you know, water, head. So, like, there's water or fluid in the head, and so then it's like pretty much a buildup of like this fluid that's in between your brain and spinal cord, which is called cerebrospinal fluid, where there's like too much in the brain. It pretty much just surrounds the brain and the spinal cord, and like it causes like widenings in the brain called ventricles, I believe. Yeah, it causes widenings in the brain, like spaces in between the brain and the skull, which can cause it to like put pressure on the brain tissue and stuff like that. So, the history of this, there's been a lot of cases, like, even, like, long ago, even in the 20th century, that they found being described by multiple people, of course, over the years. And, like, back then, they thought it was extracerebral accumulation of water, so, like, water outside the brain building up. Then these two people, Frank Nolson and Eugene Spitz, they created like a shunt that you put inside. Well, no, they didn't create it, but they were the first people to successfully implant one into someone with hydrocephalus into their brain. This was in 1949. Yeah, this was in 1949. Pretty much a shunt is just something they use to like draw out the fluid or draw out the water that's in the brain so that there isn't any more. There's like different types of hydrocephalus. There's congenital and compensate. This one pretty much is the same thing because they're both like present at birth, but like compensate hydrocephalus is like, well, it's in the name, it's compensated, and it usually doesn't have any symptoms from when the person is born to when they grow up. Like, but congenital, both of them actually can be caused by like things happening during the development of the child or the fetus, or like genetically, like genetic mutations and stuff like that, which means it can also be inherited. So yeah. And then acquired hydrocephalus is pretty much, it just, you acquire it, it's in the name, you acquire it like after birth or sometime after birth, whether that's like immediately after delivery or 4 or 5 years old and stuff like that. You know, this is usually caused by like another disease or injury, like head trauma and stuff. But this one of course, can affect people of all ages. It doesn't have to just be children just born or toddlers and stuff like that. It can affect older people, of course. Yeah. It actually does affect old people quite a bit. I believe 1 in 100 old people or older people have hydrocephalus. Another one is communicating and non-communicating hydrocephalus. The flow, well, in communicating, the flow of cerebrospinal fluid. I'm just gonna say CSF, like the flow of CSF. CSF is blocked after it exits the ventricle, which is like just the space in the brain. It's blocked. So that's communicating, and then non-communicating, which is also given the name obstructive hydrocephalus. It's when the flow of CSF is blocked in one or more like passages connecting the ventricle. So it's just like in multiple passages that connect the spaces in the head. That's where it's blocked. And then some other forms are also known as abnormal. There's an abnormal increase in CFS in the ventricles that's caused by head trauma or tumor or disease, infection, stuff like that. Around 375 like old people are believed to have it. It's not an approximate number because there's not very much research over it, but there are that many old Americans that we know of that are believed to have normal pressure hydrocephalus, which is the name of this one. And then hydrocephalus ex vocale is when the brain shrinks, which causes the ventricles. Like, usually it's caused by like stroke or trauma, or like injury to the brain. So yeah, it's caused by a stroke. And if people don't know what a stroke is pretty much just like the cutoff of blood to your brain. So yeah, it's like that can cause the brain to shrink, which would create the ventricles inside of the brain. And this one was called hydrocephalus ex vocale because of that. I believe the term ex vocale means they don't give us a definition of the word ex vocale, but yeah, pretty much that's pretty much what just happens with this type. It's diagnosed with like MRIs and CT scans and stuff like that. There's like actual, you know, these things, you know, as like actual devices, imaging devices that are used to look at brain injuries and stuff like that, you know. And like, it really honestly just depends on who the person is, as in the individual, because depending on like what type of hydrocephalus they have or how old they are, how they got it, they use different tools and stuff. And it's also like the symptoms, I guess, that are present or shown.
Successor to what?
Like, the things that they suspect are going on, you know. That's, they use different types of devices. Like, they also use ultrasound. So they may use ultrasound for somebody who they believe has this type of thing, this type of hydrocephalus, because of what's present, what they can see, you know, the symptoms that they are showing. So yeah, that's how it's diagnosed.
10% of them are going,
and then a lot of people can get it,
approximately 10 to 20% are going to college. What do you think? What does that mean?
That's like
they're not successful,
ranging from infants to older adults in between that range. And it's like studies have found that for every 1,000 babies born, there's one or two that have hydrocephalus. And then, as I said before, there's one in 100 seniors that are believed to also have hydrocephalus. September is hydrocephalus awareness month, I believe.
Have to go a long way to get to the college.
So yeah,
that's okay. All right, I'll let you get back to it.
It's kind of hard to predict a prognosis for hydrocephalus because, like, researchers don't have a clear understanding. Regardless of how long, like, despite how long it's been, or, like, I think that's mainly because of the presence of it, the prevalence of it. You know, it's not like cancer or heart disease and stuff like that. People, researchers don't have enough information on it in order to predict a prognosis. But, like, they think there's a correlation between, like, symptoms and the outcome. Or, like, what caused the hydrocephalus. Whether that's, like, genetic. Of course, if it's genetic, they'll understand how to predict. They'll be able to predict, like, if the child has it, stuff like that, if it's a recessive dominant trait. But it's like, you know, people who do have it, people who do have hydrocephalus, and families who do have family members with hydrocephalus, you know, they want them to be aware of, like, the risks of it, whether that's a family member who has acquired it, a family member who's just born with it, or a family member who is about to be born, who may be born with it, just depending on, like, the family history and stuff. Symptoms in infants and children versus symptoms with, like, young, middle-aged adults, and then versus symptoms in older adults are pretty different, but they're generally the same.
This seems like a smaller gradient because they only start in
You don't got enough slides.
Oh, yes, I do. I'll finish right.
You don't have enough slides, I promise.
She said we need.
Okay, so as I was saying before, the symptoms between children and infants and then young adults, teenagers, and older adults are pretty different, but they're generally the same. So here I have a picture of... Here I have a picture of a child, probably around the age of 2 or 1. He has hydrocephalus. As you can see, his head is actually larger than usual. You know, it kind of affects his eyes too, because his eyes are actually in a kind of weird position. But the symptoms usually are the abnormally large head, which is a pretty common feature among hydrocephalics. Simply because of the extra space in the head, it causes the brain, well, not the brain, but it causes the head to be abnormally big because of all the spaces that are in it. So, and because it's obviously a brain issue, there are going to be seizures involved. So seizures are also a symptom of hydrocephalus. There are also some behavioral symptoms, you know, which because of this, because there's, well, as I said before, this is a brain condition, so it's obviously going to have some effect on the brain, like change in personality or like a delay of learning skills, like simple skills like tying your shoes, walking, talking, conversing with people. Even just balance, pretty much. It has a lot of impact on the cognitive portion of the brain. Symptoms in older people, like young adults and middle-aged adults, teenagers, is like lethargy, lethargy is like not being able to do something, like being tired, pretty much just being tired and having like a lack of energy or motivation to do things. You know, it can even cause a limited mental capacity. Also, as I said before, loss of coordination or balance, you know, they may not be able to do things like simply pick things up, walk in a straight line, just walk probably in general, you know. So yeah, it can affect people in that way. In older adults, it can get a little more serious. As I mentioned before, there's lots of, in older adults, considering it, a lot of older adults have acquired hydrocephalus if they didn't have it before. Most do. They lose their critical thinking skills, like reasoning, you know, distinguishing difference between simple things like an apple or an orange. You know, they may lose the ability to do that. It can affect their walking, and I'm not just talking like not being able to walk on a straight line or not being able to walk down the stairs without losing your balance a little bit. I mean, like, actually being unable to walk. You know, maybe not being necessarily unable to walk, but it's harder for them to walk. You know, it's like they're having to relearn how to walk because their brain has lost the ability to do that. You know, they aren't able to do that anymore. They lost the ability to do it. Treatment, there aren't any treatments for it. As I said before, there's very limited information on it. There's not much research on it. Especially since it's such a rare disease, it doesn't show up very often. As I said, 1 in 1,000, 2 in 1,000 babies have it, 1 in 100 older adults have it. So there's not very much to go off of, considering it's not very prevalent, you know. It's pretty rare, you know. It's identified as a rare disease. So there's not very many preventions or cures about it, especially since they can't come up with a diagnosis, a prognosis for it. They're not able to make predictions or preventions or possibly cures for that. But there are treatments like a shunt, which you pretty much they pretty much surgically implant into your brain. As I mentioned earlier in this podcast, the first person to actually do that was Nolson and Spitz in 1949. They were the first person to actually successfully surgically implant a shunt into a hydrocephalic brain. So yeah, that's the way to treat it. Pretty much what a shunt is, it's like a plastic tube. It's a hard plastic tube that like directs the fluid, the cerebrospinal fluid, to another region of the body so it can be like circulated correctly and absorbed into another region of the body. Yeah, there's if it's diagnosed early enough in its early stages, usually infants, they are able to lead a normal life. Like Junior, you know, he was the doctors were able to find out when he was pretty young, relatively young. So, as of now, you know, he, in the book that we've read, he's able to do basketball, you know. He's been in a few fights even, and yet he's still able to live a normal life, live with a normal lifespan, you know. He's actually pretty smart, too, and intelligent, so you can tell it didn't have too much of a cognitive impact on his brain. Yeah, just like him, if treated early on and diagnosed early on, these people usually are able to live a normal lifespan. They're able to do basketball, go swimming, play soccer, you know, test with typical kids and stuff like that. You know, the mortality rate for younger children with hydrocephalus it's only 5%. So that's suggesting that if it's found out and treated early enough, that, you know, infants are pretty likely to be able to live, and not only live, but live normal lives as a typical child. There's a lot of people that are doing research, though. Despite the lack of research that there is, there are still people doing research. Like, there's this National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, and then National Institutes of Health, and then there's an actual hydrocephalus research network, and they're all doing research on brain conditions, not just hydrocephalus, but other brain conditions, as you can tell in their titles, you know, neurological disorders and stroke. They're doing research on brain conditions like this to, you know, help treat it and prevent it, you know, maybe cure it, stuff like that, because there's not enough research already on it. So these institutes and these organizations and networks, they're working to help people with hydrocephalus and help them lead normal lives and such. So this, in comparison to other neurological disorders, I believe there is pain. There could be pain. There's not always pain, but there is.
His girlfriend, you know, at the time.
So honestly, I'd say that heterosexuals, it's not as common or talked about as other neurological disorders. You know, you always hear people talk about dementia, Alzheimer's, strokes, brain tumors, brain cancer, stuff like that. But you never really hear people talk about hydrocephalus. And honestly, it's just the research isn't there, you know. People are always talking about brain cancer. They have research on brain cancer. Brain cancer is pretty, you know, prevalent. Dementia, Alzheimer's, it's pretty prevalent. Even epilepsy, like, and seizures and stuff like that, that's pretty prevalent and common. You know, they show up in a lot of people, but hydrocephalus, you don't really see it. Like, probably Alzheimer's probably affects, let's see, like, probably half the old people population, whereas hydrocephalus only affects one person. So yeah, that's a big difference in percentage. It just doesn't show up as much, and there's not very much research. Why did it get so quiet? Then they say there's not very much deaths recorded on hydrocephalus either. So, as other brain diseases, you know, there's a lot of people that die from brain cancer, but you don't hear very much. But yeah, the lives of children with diseases like this, well, hydrocephalus specifically, because that's what this topic is about. The lives of children can be normal, and half the time they are. But a lot of the time, they may not be. They're probably. Well, not probably, but they do have trouble doing simple tasks and stuff like that simply because of a brain condition that affects their ability to think correctly and stuff like that. And I find it really disappointing that there's not very much research on it. I don't know if it's like there's not enough people researching on it, people don't want to research on it, they really don't have an understanding on it, but I think it's like there's just not enough people looking up this thing, trying to understand it. And there's also just not enough cases on it. I don't know how rare it is, because it honestly just varies between, like, family with hydrocephalus and family without hydrocephalus, but there's just not very much, there's not very many cases on it. You can walk away now.
Presentation. Doing presentation. Yep, doing it. Continue your work.
So as I was saying, there's different types of causes on hydrocephalus, actually. Like acquired hydrocephalus and congenital, not just, well, to go more into depth of those genetic anomalies. Apparently, it's just like, there's something called Dandy Walker syndrome. It's just, it says a fourth ventricle becomes enlarged because its outlets are partially or completely closed and part of the cerebellum fails to develop. So it's like lack of development in the cerebellum. And then acquired hydrocephalus, specifically like meningitis. And it's actually like considered that people ask doctors whether or not they should get a meningitis shot because apparently meningitis can cause hydrocephalus. And then, of course, brain injuries. Even brain tumors can cause it. And hemorrhaging can cause hydrocephalus. And then there's even some complications of shunt systems. There's some complications, like it's recommended that people go to the doctor, like weekly, monthly checkups to make sure that their shunt system works, because it can malfunction, it can become infected, it can drain too much, drain not enough, it can cause seizures, but it can even cause like abdominal complications, like that's even really scary. So, yeah. And then some work-cited pages, some sources that I used for like the actual Hydrocephalus Association itself, Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, Mayo Clinic for like symptoms and stuff, and even the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, them themselves. I was able to get some information from them about this. It's just a really interesting disease, you know, considering it's not really known about. I remember reading the book. I had no idea what he was talking about. I was like, what is water on the brain? Are you just playing, dumping a water bottle on your head or something? Like, what is it? So, it just goes to show it's not as common as brain cancer, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, stuff like that. I just thought it was a really cool disorder, disease to research on just because of the lack, despite the lack of research that there actually is.